وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration. Accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child. And Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to Iran Radio, and I'm your host, Asma. I hope you have enjoyed our program up until now. Up next, we have news keeping you updated with the latest headlines. Then we have Radio Productions, delivering another wave of informative content curated just for you by our dedicated team. Next up, the Ocean of God dives deep into spiritual supplications. In this program, we reflect on the rich spiritual heritage of Islamic supplications and ziyarat texts passed down from the Ahlul Bayt as beautifully preserved in dua collections like Mafatih al-Jinan. Each episode offers a brief yet meaningful commentary on selected du'as and ziyarat. Following that, another segment of Radio Productions, we've put together a variety of engaging pieces for your listening enjoyment. Discover something new with us. Stay tuned for the news, please.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran reiterates triggering a 2015 nuclear deal snapback mechanism by the European Troika is legally flawed and all UN sanctions should be terminated. Gaza officials say nearly 40 Palestinians have been killed since the enforcement of the ceasefire as the Israeli regime continues to violate the truce. Pakistan and Afghanistan have agreed to an immediate ceasefire brokered by Qatar and Turkey to end deadly border clashes. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on the World News. Now Iran has once again called for the termination of all UN Security Council sanctions under Resolution 2231, emphasizing that the document is expired and thus its prohibitions are no longer in effect. In a social media post, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said that Iran, China, and Russia affirm In accordance with operative paragraph 8 of the resolution, all restrictions are terminated as of October 18th. He said the attempt by the European Troika to trigger the so-called snapback mechanism of the nuclear deal is by default legally and procedurally flawed. Araghchi's remarks follow a joint letter by Iran, Russia, and China to the UN chief and president of the Security Council, stressing expiration of Resolution 2231, which endorsed the 2015 deal, the JCPOA. It said the European parties to the agreement have failed to implement their obligations, and the three countries added the E3 did not go through the process stipulated in the dispute resolution mechanism either and are not qualified to invoke its provisions. Political analyst Robert Fantina joined us earlier to discuss legal basis for the decision taken by the U.S. and E3 to reimpose sanctions on Iran despite UN Resolution 2231 expiring.
Iranian spokespeople have said clearly that the provisions all expired as of the 18th today and that the agreement no longer exists. These countries are trying to implement penalties on Iran for their own lack of adherence to the agreement. It makes no sense. And as you mentioned, the Western nations are trying to, and with some success, unfortunately, influence the United Nations in a variety of ways because of their power in the world, these countries' power in the world. But the idea of the sanctions being reimposed and not being dropped, because they have been reimposed, and not being dropped makes no sense from a legal standpoint, because the JCPOA, the UN resolution, which was endorsed by UN Resolution 2331, has expired. So the agreement is over and done with. Any sanctions should not be reimposed, and all that have been reimposed should be removed immediately under international law. The United States and most Western nations, its allies certainly, can't be trusted to uphold their agreements, as we saw from the JCPOA. Now, the fact that this is coming to the United Nations and the United Nations is not following its own protocols further erodes its credibility.
11 years ago, on October 19th, Press TV lost one of its most dedicated journalists. Serena Shen became an inspiration to many with her courageous endeavors in several countries in the region and beyond, reporting in the most dangerous zones. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, reports.
11 years since her tragic death, Serena Shem is still remembered by friends and colleagues at Press TV as the most hardworking and outward reporter.
I do remember the days 11 years back when we first applied for Press TV. It was the same day. We got accepted at the same day, and I was captivated by a character that was like no, and does not look like any other character that I've ever seen before. Brave, full of life, and she knew exactly what she wanted to do.
Serena lost her life in a car crash in Suruk, Turkey, on October 19. 2 days before her death, Serena said during a live coverage on Press TV that she had received death threats from anonymous sources in connection with her reporting about the transfer of Daesh terrorists from Turkey to Syria under the cover of the World Food Program.
I do also remember an email that was sent to me by her when she felt that a threat was coming towards her. And she said, Farah, I knew that this is the biggest risk I might take in my life, but I want to do it. And then I had one simple question. I said, why would you want to do that as long as you know that you might lose, that you might lose your life eventually? And you have two small children that are waiting for you at the corner. She said that I always wanted and I always chased justice.
The fatal car crash happened as Serena was on her way back from reporting about clashes in Turkish areas on the border with the Syrian town of Kobani, one of the many war zones she chose to cover.
I think that Serena, yep, she did go to hot spots like Iraq, like Syria, I think Ukraine as well, with other places. So there was ambition which was involved. At the same time, she was risking her life in order to spread the story or let the truth be told. And I think that you saw a lot of this happening recently now with the new wars we had in the region in Gaza, where I think journalism became all the more important.
Although Turkish authorities said the incident was an accident, Serena's family still has many questions, but they were not available for comment. conflicting accounts about her death and her comments that Turkish intelligence had accused her of spying all raised suspicions about the circumstances of her death. But with all said and done, she will always be remembered as one of Press TV's most dedicated and self-sacrificing correspondents. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Although a ceasefire between Hamas and the Israeli regime in Gaza is largely holding, Palestinian death toll still continues to rise. The Gaza government media office said it's documented at least 47 violations by the Israeli regime since the ceasefire took effect over a week ago, adding regime breaches include direct fire, shelling, and arrests, and have left nearly 40 Palestinians dead and over 140 injured. Gaza hospitals received nearly 30 bodies on Saturday, including 4 killed by direct occupation fire. Israel also delivered the bodies of 15 more Palestinians through the Red Cross, raising total number of bodies received from the occupying entity in 4 batches now to 135. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, many of the bodies received thus far show signs of torture, physical abuse, and restraint. Military wing of Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigades, also handed over the bodies of 2 more Israeli captives in southern Gaza. The death toll for regime genocide since October of 2023 is a push beyond 68,100, along with 170,200 Palestinians injured. We're going to check into Deir al-Balah in central Gaza now and hook up with Ghada Ibrahim, our correspondent, with your latest on the ground there. Ghada, so a week now into this so-called ceasefire in Gaza, what are things on the ground looking like?
Yes, despite the idea that this ceasefire has already begun 10 days ago, however, the death toll continues to rise in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation army keeps violating the ceasefire, and according to Gaza Media Office, at least 47 violations were documented and reported as a result of the Israeli army violating the ceasefire agreement. While that, these violations are including actually direct attacks on Palestinians in all the areas. Until now, we're still hearing the shooting from the tanks towards the eastern parts of the city, towards the eastern parts of Al-Qarara, Khan Yunis, and Fanis Hela areas. Also in the eastern parts of Al-Shijaya and Al-Zaytun areas. These areas, people are trying to go back to their cities, trying to go back to their neighborhoods, to return to their areas. However, they are only met with direct shooting and direct gunfire from the Israeli troops and from the Israeli forces in these areas in particular. The death toll since the beginning of this ceasefire has increased to be 29 at least. Many were actually reported injured. At least 150 Palestinians were injured critically because of the direct shooting and because of the drones attacks on the people's gatherings and the people who are trying to return to their areas in the eastern parts of the city. In the meantime, we are talking about the Palestinian factions has already earlier this night handed over two corpses of captives that were actually found under the rubble in the north parts of Khan Yunis city. The digging is continuous, and the Palestinian factions are still searching for the remaining captives, who are estimated to be 16 remaining under the rubble of these areas that were actually demolished completely and bombed repeatedly by the Israeli occupation forces as they were actually invading in the north of Khan Yunis city. Nowadays, more Palestinians are still, more than 10,000 Palestinians are still under the rubble of the Gaza Strip, where hundreds of families are still waiting and searching for any hope to bring them or to retrieve the bodies of the Palestinians from under the rubble of the destroyed buildings and the destroyed neighborhoods. However, with the minimum minimum capabilities of the civil defense workers here in the Gaza Strip, and with the challenges that are growing every passing day because of the lack of the fuel and the lack of the heavy machinery, Palestinians are unable to find or unable to retrieve the bodies of their martyrs as a result of the Israeli banning of entry of heavy machinery into the Gaza Strip. the situation remains really tense, and people are cautiously, actually, receiving this ceasefire. And they are actually, it is obvious that at any time it might collapse because of the repetitive Israeli violations. And the biggest of these, and the most important of these violations, is the Israeli occupation regime that continues to hinder the entry of aid into the Gaza Strip and is still not abiding to the humanitarian protocol agreed upon in the ceasefire deal. The border crossings here in the Gaza Strip are now trickling with aid, and what is entering into the Gaza Strip is only a trickle of aid. Nothing on the ground, no change is seen on the ground for real. We are actually, many families, many people are still struggling to find the basics of survival. Many hospitals, all the hospitals in the Gaza Strip, are now struggling to provide the medical care and to provide the medical assistance for the patients who are in dire need, and is still the cases that are still deteriorating, waiting impatiently for the medical supplies and the aid.
All right, Gada, thank you for the update. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Gada Ibrahim joining us from central Gaza. Meanwhile, thousands have marched in Paris in solidarity with Palestinians. The rally, organized by Euro-Palestine, condemned Israel's continued genocide in Gaza and denounced its repeated violations of the ceasefire.
In Paris this Saturday, thousands took to the streets to support the Palestinian people and denounce Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. The demonstration, organized by the Euro-Palestine Association, comes after repeated violations of the ceasefire by Israeli forces. Marching from Place de la République, protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted for justice and liberation. For them, the so-called ceasefire changes nothing. They say Israel continues its attacks and that impunity must end.
The day after the ceasefire began, people were bombed again. It didn't stop. What we're asking for today is a permanent, radical ceasefire and a complete end to the bombings, but also justice. Because even with the ceasefire, many humanitarian laws have been broken. So today, we want justice.
Despite the ceasefire, they kept bombing. They're still letting their militias kill Palestinians in Gaza. It's disgusting. And we all know it. Netanyahu said he wouldn't leave Gaza. He's pretending to want peace. But I don't believe it for a second.
The demonstrators also denounced Western complicity, accusing France and the European Union of continuing to support Israel politically and economically, despite the ongoing genocide. Among them, Jewish activists who said their solidarity with Palestine is part of a universal fight for justice.
I'll keep fighting anyway. For me, the two-state solution is impossible. There must be one Palestinian state, from the river to the sea. That's the only viable solution.
The ceasefire has been violated 10, maybe 13 or 14 times by Israel. They want us to believe they're pulling out, but before leaving, they left massive destruction across Gaza. There are still Israeli mines there, killing children even today.
As the march ended, demonstrators vowed to continue mobilizing across France until Gaza is free. They called for sanctions against Israel and for France to take responsibility in defending international law, insisting that silence too is complicity. Qasem Hassan, Paris.
A pro-Palestinian hacking group has disclosed identities of more individuals whom it says are core to Israel's war machine. Handala published confidential and sensitive info on 17 individuals, identifying them as senior military scientists and intel officers. Group says they are key architects of destructive wars by the regime and masterminds of weapon systems it uses to, quote, bring death and misery to innocent civilians. Handala issued a warning to these individuals, saying they face imminent accountability for crimes against humanity. Last week, the group also released classified information on 13 other Israeli operatives, further exposing regime's security vulnerabilities. Handala has also carried out a series of cyber attacks targeting Israeli fuel distribution networks, air defense systems, and military satellites. Meanwhile, Pakistan and Afghanistan have agreed to an immediate ceasefire brokered by Qatar and Turkey to end deadly border clashes. The agreement reached during high-level talks in Doha with delegations led by both countries' defense ministers. The Qatari Foreign Ministry said two neighbors agreed to hold follow-up meetings to ensure that the ceasefire holds. Islamabad says talks will focus on immediate measures to end cross-border terrorism against Pakistan emanating from Afghanistan. A 48-hour truce, which began Wednesday, has been extended to allow for negotiations. Now, cross-border fighting was triggered after Pakistan demanded that Afghanistan rein in militants who had stepped up cross-border attacks. And the Taliban has denied giving safe haven to any armed groups. Clashes killed dozens and wounded hundreds in the worst violence since 2021. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
starting from Tehran, drive for about 450 kilometers and you reach Isfahan. But don't stop yet. Go yet another 25 kilometers east and you'll reach our destination, the city of Najafabad. Najafabad was first established by Shah Abbas the Great in the 16th century. That's about 400 years ago during the Safavid period and has many beautiful castles and buildings within. Today we're going to show you three of them. The Nurian House, the Husnije Caravanserai, and the Ibrahim Khan Citadel, starting with the last one.
An enclosed space of about 1.5 hectares with winding alleys and time-worn walls that remind you of the historic forts of old Persia. This is the Ibrahim Khan Citadel. That's about 10 kilometers to the west of the city of Najafabad in the province of Isfahan. Apparently, this small citadel has well over 40 houses, some of which were still occupied up to about 30 years ago.
Before these 6-meter-high walls and watchtowers were built to secure the safety of these houses, this was a small village known as Shahdan, which is why sometimes this whole structure is called the Shahdan Citadel. This is one of the few small citadels that was built during the Zand and Qajar dynasty for commoners, who were mostly farmers and animal breeders. Each adobe house has two small rooms, a kitchen and a small yard. You can also see wells in some of the remaining houses. The architecture of a citadel reflects not only the defense tactics of each historic period, but also the social structure and economic status of the people living at that time. Stand still and look around. Could you have lived as they did, sharing everything in peace and tranquility? With that said, it is time to head back into the city of Najafabad to pay a visit to our next location, that is the Nurian House. The Nurian House can be found in one of the historic neighborhoods of Najafabad called Nasir. As soon as you open the age-old wooden doors, you are led into the main courtyard through a vestibule with big flooring. The Nurian House was made in the image of the homes built on the central Iranian plateau. The courtyard is decorated with mirror flower beds to the sides and a beautiful heart-shaped miniature stone pool at the center. The facade of the main building is eye-catching indeed and is a modest example of the native architectural designs in this region. The porch, with its four delicately decorated arabesque capital head pillars, leads to the main room of the outer courtyard through wooden lattice doors with paisley designs. The ceiling of the porch is also decorated with 8-point geometric inlays. In addition to the inner and outer courtyards, you can also pay a visit to the kitchen that's undergone restoration and has a working oven, ventilation, and a display of the varying kitchenware used by the women of the household. The small stony pool is probably where watermelons were floated to cool during the summer. In the good old days, family and friends would gather around the pool and enjoy each other's company. We have to say goodbye to the Nurian House as well, if we want to reach our final stop in time. Our last destination is a memento from the Safavid period that was registered on Iran's list of National Heritage in 2000. There are many caravanserais scattered all over the province of Isfahan that were built over a time period of 10 centuries, from the 9th to the 19th century, since back then Isfahan was on one of the main trade routes of Central Asia. Back in their glory days, these caravanserais were a place of culture, trade, tradition, and most importantly, a safe haven for any caravan or traveler who passed by. And perhaps the most interesting of these places were the ones that were built in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere. Caravanserai literally means a dwelling for caravans. They are widely known for their remarkable architecture that's based on geometric equilibrium, each having a unique character. The courtyards are normally surrounded with bedrooms, depots, and bathrooms. Here too, you can see ceilings blackened by soot, a common sight in dusty places like this. The soot helps prevent dust falling on the heads and torsos of visitors who sought shelter and rest in these chambers and under these small domes. Unfortunately, except for some of the really well-known caravanserais, especially those that are inside urban areas, many have been forgotten over the course of time. This is Gulnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
The Ocean of Dua.
الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Dear listeners, within the previous programs, we were talking about the relation between prayer and action. And we said it would not be correct to try to fathom prayer independent of the norms of the Almighty Allah. The Almighty Allah has set for the human being some norms or sunan in the universe, and we have to observe those rules, and we have to go through the Almighty Allah's favors and mercies by the way and path He has set for us. and we concluded no prayer can be accepted but within the framework of the divine norms. The one who answers our calls, if we are his servants, is the very one who has laid these norms in the universal nature. And we said in the Holy Quran, he says, it is he who made the earth tractable for you, so walk on its flanks and eat of his provision. So, in the same way that prayer cannot be a substitute for putting effort, likewise acting cannot be a substitute for prayer. For the keys of this universe are in the hand of Allah, and he bestows upon his servants through the prayer what they're not able to achieve by their efforts. And he facilitates for them by virtue of prayer those natural means which they are unable to attain by their endeavors.
Alhamdulillah, khaliq al-khalq, basit al-rizq, faliq al-asbah, dhil jalal wal-ikram, wal-fadl wal-in'am, alladhi ba'uda fala yura, wa qaruba fashahida an-najwa.
But we should note that facilitation of the natural means, or al-asbab al-tabi'iyya, by the Almighty Allah for his servants, does not imply that one becomes needless of prayer, petition, and invoking Allah. This is because it is Allah the Exalted who expands and tightens. He is basit, he is expanding, and he is at the very same time tightening, or qabit, and he is the one who gives and withholds, who benefits and harms, who gives life and causes death, who exalts and abases. In his hand are the keys of the universe, and nothing in the universe can disobey his command. Every power in this universe which can benefit or harm is subject to his order and strength. And as a result, we should mention what we have previously mentioned throughout the previous programs. The Almighty Allah loves to see the servants only asking him, because he is the absolute cause. The natural agents in this vast universe have no independent existence from the will of Allah, from the intention of Allah, and from his power. And the human beings, by employing them, should not be needless of prayer, petition, and imploring Allah. And we glorify and declare Allah to be above what some Jews say about him, and the hands of Allah are tied up. As the verse of the Holy Quran says, وَقَالَتِ الْيَهُودُ يَدُ اللَّهِ مَغْلُولَةٌ. Instead, we believe in what the Holy Quran says, rather his hands are wide open. So as a result, we interact with Allah in all situations, as we do not distinguish between interaction with Allah and interaction with the norms which Allah has laid as means for the provisions of his servants. We believe that these norms and natural causes benefit and harm us in extension to the will, in extension to the desire and strength of Allah, and not independent of, or even on a par with the divine will and power. Moreover, we perceive the hand of Allah the Exalted, his mercy, bounties, and wisdom in all of our affairs, small and big, as we perceive the will of Allah, facilitation by him, and his favors throughout our lives. So, we are in need of Allah at every moment, and at every turn of our lives, and we are destitute in the face of his mercy, bounties, success, and guidance. We pray to the Almighty Allah only, and we ask him alone to take charge of all of our affairs with uprightness, and we seek refuge with him that he should not leave us on our own even for a second. We ask him not to make us dependent on other than himself.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. in as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab anjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab anjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala bas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will, God will come towards you.
Ocean of Dua.
For the one last point in this program, dear listeners, you should note that the like of this supplication that I read to you does not necessarily mean that since someone has asked the Almighty Allah to take charge of his needs, he should now keep away his needs and affairs from the people and should not employ the natural causes operating in the universe. It rather implies that one should pray to Allah to make his need toward others in extension to his need towards him, the Exalted. And this is the important point to be noted in the matter of relation between prayer and action. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We ask the Almighty Allah to give us the power and bravery to face dreadful events and situations. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
tried, he spoke words so beautiful. It's when he was told he was the chosen one. Salawatullahi alayk, oh Muhammad, oh Muhammad, sallallahu alayk Allah. The final prophet and the messenger sent from Allah. This is the story so
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Ahmad Kazmi, and in this show we delve into the forces of war, imperialism and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. Today it is a singular honour for me to be joined by Huda Amouri. Huda is a pioneering Palestinian Iraqi political leader, organiser and campaigner, best known for co-founding the Direct Action Network Palestine Action in 2020. Dedicated to disrupting the Zionist war machine in Britain, mainly by targeting Israel's largest weapons manufacturer, Elbit Systems. But earlier this year, the British government proscribed Palestine Action as a so-called terrorist organization, something which Huda is challenging in court. Indeed, Huda continues to campaign and to make sacrifices in support of Palestinian liberation, and it's my pleasure to welcome her to the show today. So Huda, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's very clear that the real foreign influence in Britain is not coming from Iran supposedly funding Palestine Action, which is a load of nonsense. It's actually the demonstrable influence of the Zionist regime through its lobby groups and indeed the Zionist movement here in Britain. I just want to turn now to the situation in Gaza. So a ceasefire has recently been approved. But that obviously isn't the end of the story, and we know as well that the story didn't start on October the 7th. Of course, when you co-founded Palestine Action in mid-2020, that was over 3 years before October the 7th. I mean, this is an issue on which you, I, so many other people have been campaigning for years. And that's because Zionism has always been a racist colonial ideology that seeks to eradicate all of Palestine and expand even beyond those borders to create a greater Israel. So a ceasefire in Gaza is not the end of Zionism. It's not even the end of suffering in Gaza. Is there a danger that with this ceasefire, some people will lose sight of what's at stake? And what's your advice to people who may be slightly overexcited about what this ceasefire means?
Yeah, I think that the genocide in Gaza has reached so many people across the world that people are forced to notice. And a lot of those people weren't paying attention before October 7th. And I remember when October 7th, just how many people were wanting to take direct action who hadn't necessarily been involved before, and that was quite new. For people who have been involved for years and years to see to see people willing to risk their liberty for something where it was a, you know, they recently learned about it through the genocide that was happening in Gaza. Like you said, Palestine Action had existed in 2020, and the reason we existed because there was the occupation of Gaza, of the West Bank, occupation of historic Palestine, the continued colonization, the continued, you know, besiegement of Gaza, and the goal and the existence of these weapons factories. And I think, just go back to the Elbit weapons factories, the only reason they exist is because of the destruction of Palestine. So if this ceasefire meant that the testing of weapons, the testing of surveillance technology would cease to exist, that system of oppression, of military subjugation of the Palestinian people would cease to exist, Elbit wouldn't exist. So when you can see the symptoms and the outcomes of the Zionist regime and oppression of Palestinians existing in your towns and cities, so long as they exist, there is also the continued colonization of Palestine. That's why Palestine Action was very adamant we had to shut down these factories. They existed to destroy Palestine. So by shutting them down, we are acting towards the struggle for Palestinian liberation. And we have got to, in whichever way we can, maintain and grow the struggle against the Zionist regime, against the oppression of Palestinians. And let's be honest, the situation in Gaza is very, very fragile and uncertain. I sense that it will still be highly militarized in a lot of ways. And we have a responsibility to see this through until a free Palestine. We have made massive steps forward in terms of the international boycott movement, in terms of people turning on the Zionist regime. And I hope this ceasefire holds. I hope that people in Palestine and Gaza get the relief that they so desperately need. But we need to use all of that strength we have gained as a movement to just keep going, keep applying the pressure, keep shutting down these places until Palestine is free. And, you know, I just can't emphasize that enough, that our solidarity is not contingent on, at that very moment, Palestinians going through the worst reality imaginable. We do not only stand up for them when they are literally going through the most extreme form of a genocide, because when that stops, it doesn't suddenly become a liberation. We have to fight for liberation. We have to fight to get to that point. What we've done now is just pause the worst phase of the Zionist regime in this moment. But a slow genocide and the continued occupation, the continued militarization of Palestine, the continued settlement building, etc., is killing Palestinians every single day. The violence continues, and we just have to keep fighting until Palestine is liberated. And I do believe that, you know, we can get there within our lifetime. I think a lot of things have changed now, and the movement's been bigger than ever. And I think we just have to keep going.
I just want to turn back to the situation with Palestine Action, because obviously you're continuing to legally challenge the prescription, and you've been granted permission for a judicial review, and that hearing will be taking place, as I understand it, in late November this year. Can you give us a brief overview of the legal arguments that you're making in that judicial review?
Yeah, so we've been granted the judicial review on two grounds, one being that the prescription is disproportionate to freedom of speech and the right to protest, which I think has been very evident by not just the arrest of people holding signs saying they support Palestine Action, but also the arrest of people for, you know, holding up private eye jokes or the Plasticine Action t-shirts. And actually, you know, we've seen academics now being disciplined for signing a letter saying they oppose the prescription of Palestine Action, just for opposing a law. But this has had very far-reaching consequences for freedom of speech, and that's just on the people who've been directly affected. Actually, the chilling effect of that is probably in the hundreds of thousands in terms of people who want to say certain things but are unable to say it because they are scared of the repercussions. And I think that is a huge problem now because of the prescription. And the second ground is that the government, Yvette Cooper, failed to consult Palestine Action on the prescription. And that's actually quite important, because what she did do was she consulted the Israeli lobby, she consulted the Israeli government, she consulted these weapons manufacturers, these lords, pro-Israel lobby groups, including, you know, We Believe in Israel, Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. They were very involved in this process. But what she did not do was consult Palestine Action or any human rights organizations before she decided to prescribe Palestine Action. So it's very clear that she had failed in that duty when she made this decision. And so that will go ahead on the 25th to 27th of November, and hopefully we would get a result 2 weeks after that. The government is trying to appeal the decision, which allowed us to go for judicial review, which is very interesting when they won't even, you know, they are appealing before you even get the chance to actually argue the case fully in court to try and protect themselves from legal scrutiny. But that has already been heard. We're waiting for a result on that. Yeah, inshallah, that goes well. So we should be on track for the judicial review to go ahead at the end of November.
And how can people support the judicial review, either, you know, financially or in other ways?
So actually, we have had so much support before the prescription. I don't know if you saw, but we raised like £100,000 in 24 hours for these fees. So we are thankfully covered in terms of the legal fees, just because of how many people so quickly, you know, in a week before prescription, donated to help the legal challenge. So thank you to everyone for that. To support, people can come down to the actual judicial review. It is complicated legally to say exactly what you can and can't say. I'm not, you know, I don't think anyone knows that truly, because of the amount of different arrests that have taken place. But, you know, we also know that defender juries are escalating their campaign in November ahead of the judicial review, and I believe during the actual judicial review is taking place. So you can also support them in that campaign. And also just, you know, sharing and supporting online in any way you can, raising awareness of what's going on. Get down there if you can, and obviously just be aware of whatever risks you take by whatever you say outside of the courtroom. But I think as well, in the build up to it, it's just maintaining the pressure, maintaining the momentum. We've seen so many different types of groups come out with statements, coming out in the media against this prescription, and just keeping that up.
Lastly, I just wanted to ask you about all of these different direct action groups popping up in Britain and across the world who are continuing to go after the Zionist war machine. I'm not going to name them, but there are lots of examples that we could talk about. It shows that they can prescribe Palestine Action, but the genie is out of the bottle now, isn't it?
Exactly. Exactly. What Palestine Action did was direct action against the Israeli weapons factories. We had a strategy, and we used tactics that have been used for decades, if not way longer than that, in terms of direct action. It cannot, you know, they can prescribe Palestine Action, they cannot stop direct action happening against these weapons manufacturers.
And of course, we need to continue to push for the deprescription of Palestine Action, which is, you know, vital not just to protect the people who have been arrested, arrested and who are being charged, but also to ensure that we draw a line in the sand and we say to the British state that they're not going to get away with this, and also, you know, to the Zionist regime itself, that your overreach and infiltration of our government is not going to have the effects that you think it will, and we will continue to fight you and we will win. But I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Huda, I really appreciate you doing me the honor of appearing on Attrition, and I have to say that to me and countless others, you are a living legend and an inspiration, and I thank you for everything that you've done and continue to do for the cause of Palestinian liberation. So thank you again for joining me.
Thank you so much, and for everything you're doing.
Well, what I'm doing is very minor in comparison, but thank you very much again. See you on the next one.
The world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Greetings, everyone. This is Iran Radio, broadcasting from the bustling capital of Tehran. We are ready to share more programs for the next hour. Let's check out the next lineup. Our next program is Dialogue. This program offers a unique look at the most important conversations and dialogues between Shia infallible imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of different Islamic faith and sects on various religious topics, doctrines, and also political, social, and cultural issues. Then we have Israel Watch. This program offers a critical look at Zionist media narratives and their views on West Asia. Hosted from Beirut, an expert guest joins for engaging discussions, challenging biased reports, and shedding light on Israel's actions in occupied Palestine. Next up, Ulema's Speak shares scholarly wisdom. Following that, we have Round the World with Reporters. Stay with us for the next program, Dialogue.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today, we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions, and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. And His Eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe.